The Ghost Galaxies by Piers Anthony. Part 1.
"8.81?"
The pilot's voice counted off over the intercom. 30 seconds passed.
8.82.
Captain Shetland's eye passed to the hunched man seated across the cabin, then went on to the port. Already the red shift, or something analogous, was distorting the view of space. What an anachronism, he thought. A direct vision port on a faster-than-light ship. The Meg, too, was fresh from the construction dock, and theoretically designed throughout for FTL travel.
"Light speed,"
the intercom announced, and the port was void.
8.83.
"Thank you, Johns," the captain said. His voice did not reflect the tension he felt.
Shetland had passed the speed of light many times, but never with comfort. FTL was not simply a high velocity. The restrictions of conventional physics could not be set aside with impunity. In the captain's mind were four great dreads, and as he closed his eyes, a notebook appeared with an old-fashioned wire coil binding. On its cover was a picture of a small and shaggy pony with a single word, "Private." The booklet opened, exposing a lightly ruled sheet, and from offstage appeared an animated pencil, freshly sharpened, tooth marks on the latter end. The pencil twirled and wrote,
"The four deadly dreads of Captain Shetland. 1. Beacon. Failure of. 2. Drive. Malfunction of. 3. Personality. Distortion of. 4. Unknown. The."
It pleased him to note, as always, the alphabetical arrangement of the terms, and the entire mental process of itemizing them reassured him. Fears that could be outlined in a notebook lost some of their power. This was good, for their power was great. One of them had taken, after 30 hours, the Meg-1. "Stop that," he commanded himself. Even his carelessly wandering thoughts were exceedingly dangerous in FTL. Shetland's gaze returned to the seated man. This was Somnanda, operator of the beacon. Somnanda sat without motion or expression. His forehead was high, the hair above it dark but sparse. His long ears seemed to be listening intently for something beyond the confines of the cabin, of the ship itself. His eyes, half-closed, were a curious, faded grey, their colour suggesting a nictitating membrane. The lips and mouth were more delicate than one would expect in so large a man. Somnanda gave the impression of nobility, almost of sainthood. On the table before him was a small box with a facsimile of a burning candle above it. Somnanda's unwavering gaze centered upon this light. His two mighty hands rested above the table, blue-ridged veins curling over the raised tendons in back. The fingers touched the surface lightly on either side of the candle. Somnanda moved. His head swiveled gradually, turret-like, to cover Shetland.
"It is well, Captain," he said.
His voice so deep and strong that there almost seemed to be a staccato echo from the walls surrounding them. Shetland relaxed at last. Behind his eyes, the notebook reappeared, reopened. The pencil drew a neat line through dread number one. The beacon was functioning properly, so far. When a ship entered FTL, the normal universe existed only tenuously. Relative to that ship, to its crew and many of its instruments, planets and even stars became ghost-like, present but insubstantial. External light and gravity registered only as an indication on a meter. Internally, the laws of physics applied as always. Meg 2 required power for illumination, temperature control, the operation of its instruments, and the rapid rotation that provided artificial gravity. But physical communication with Earth, and any electronic or laser-based signal had to be regarded as such, was impossible, because the ship no longer occupied the same specific universe as Earth. There was complex circuitry embedded in the table beneath Somnanda's tapering fingers, but it was psionic circuitry, incomprehensible to normal science. The actual mechanism for communication was largely in the operator's mind and subject to no tangible verification, aside from the fact that it worked.
The light, a flickering mock candle, was the evidence that the beacon was functioning. It lit the way to Earth. No instrument could retrace the course of the Meg 2 with sufficient accuracy to bring the ship home. Not when the distance traveled was to be measured in megaparsecs. Not when the universe itself was indistinct. Only this steady beacon, this metaphysical elastic connection, could guide them back even to the correct galactic cluster. Only Somnanda.
Captain. Shetland recovered with a start. I'm sorry, Somnanda. Was I worrying again?
The man smiled slowly.
No, Captain. You were not disturbing the beacon. I wished simply to remind you that your move was due.
Shetland had forgotten their game of chess. The lonely hours of space made some sort of diversion essential.
Of course. He closed his eyes, seeing the checkered board. His king was in check.
White, 23. King to King 2.
No pun intended.
Somnanda nodded. It would be another hour before he replied with his own move, for he, like the captain, was a deliberate man. There was time, and each development was to be savored, never rushed.
Somnanda, he said. The somber head rose. Do you know the purpose of this expedition?
The Milky Way galaxy is only 30,000 parsecs in diameter, Somnanda replied seriously. Far too small to test the beacon properly. We are traveling far. That should be added to the notebook, Shetland thought. The understatement of the space age.
The Meg 2's itinerary was to take her literally to the edge of the universe, as had that of the first Meg.
Captain, why did their conversation lapse so readily?
Again, Somnanda?
There is an imbalance in the beacon.
Shetland felt the cold clutch of fear at his stomach. Immediately the candle flickered higher, a yellowish flash. Fear was the nemesis of the beacon. No error there. What irony if his own alarm at news of danger to the beacon should extinguish it. He exerted control over his emotions, watched the little flame subside and become even. This was a temporary measure. Somnanda, a man of polite conservatism, had given clear warning. Something was interfering with the function of the beacon. It was not serious at the moment, but in FTL such things seldom resolved themselves. As the Meg's speed increased, so would the disturbance, until firm action became mandatory. But what was the source? It had to be a man who either knew or suspected their true mission and was frightened by it. The great majority of the crewmen had not been informed of the special nature of this mission and had no way to learn that the Meg was establishing records in FTL.
A notebook reappeared. The pencil turned about, erased the first dread, wrote it in again without the line through the words. It sketched an arrow leading from it down to number 3. Personality. Distortion of. Linked dangers. The pencil hesitated, then made subheadings under number 3, leaving a space after each. A. Somnanda. B. Shetland. C. Johns. D. Beaton. The captain noted the inversely alphabetized listing and frowned, but let it stand. The pencil returned to the first, paused again, wrote A. Somnanda. Most experienced and reliable communicator in space. Steady temper. Personal friend. Was he allowing friendship to influence him? This could not be afforded. The pencil backtracked, crossed out the last two words. Still, Somnanda was the least likely of suspects. If he lost control, there would be no appeal. No one else could maintain the beacon. B. Shetland. Captain. Experienced. Knowledge of danger. Can control emotion. How can a man judge himself? In the act of writing, he crossed out a word, made a correction. He only suspected the various dangers, could not claim full knowledge. Yet his position was unique. He alone had sufficient information to accomplish their mission.
He had to exonerate himself or admit failure at the outset. Rationalization? C. Johns, pilot, drive mechanic. The pencil stopped. The record said that Johns was competent, but Shetland had not voyaged with him before. How could he be sure of this man? Or was he allowing himself to be prejudiced because Johns had replaced another friend? Objectivity was essential. He would have to talk with Johns, but not immediately. The man, his schedule informed him, was about to go off duty and would not return until the 18th hour. That was convenient for another reason. It was also important not to upset the sleeping schedule. Lack of sleep was one of the surest routes to emotional imbalance. D. Beaton, cartographer, apprentice. The pencil stalled once more. Apprentice. That meant he had never had an assignment in FTL before. Shetland had not even met him. Young, inexperienced, and in a position to comprehend both mission and danger, a very likely suspect. But again, the time was not now. Special factors had relevance, and a proper interview was quite possibly essential to the success of the mission. Shetland turned about and set course for his own cabin. He was not tired, but he intended to sleep. Ship's clock said 19. Shetland entered the pilot's compartment and stood behind the man. "Johns," he said. The pilot jumped to attention. "Sir." He was a small, somewhat stout man, whose thin blonde hair made his scalp seem prematurely bald. His features were regular, except for a slightly receding chin. Shetland knew from the records, which were comprehensive, that Johns was an excellent craftsman well suited to his job. Shetland knew, and tried to suppress, his irrational dislike of the man. "I see we stand at 19," he said, sounding inane in his own ears. "That, of course, is our velocity, in spite of the fact that we schedule the affairs of the ship by that clock. Would you care to translate our speed into something more specific?" Johns tried to restrain a patronizing smile. "As you know, sir, the drive is designed to reflect speed in miles per hour, varying exponentially with the passage of time. Our velocity is indicated by the logarithmic dial of the ship's clock. Thus, our present speed relative to galactic stasis at..." "Assume that I'm an idiot," Shetland said.
"Yes, sir."
Johns tried again.
"When the clock indicates one, it means that the ship is travelling at 10 raised to the first power, or 10 miles per hour. At 2, this is equivalent to 10 squared, or 100 miles per hour. 3, on the clock, is 1,000 mph. 4 is 10,000 mph, and so on. 9 is already beyond the speed of light."
"Very good. Why, then, do we call it a clock?"
"Because that's what it is, sir. The figure on the dial also represents the time and hours since the drive was cut in. That's the way they engineered it. We have been underway for..." He glanced again at the clock. 19:12 hours, and our present velocity, therefore, is..."
A second pause to manipulate his slide rule, while Shetland smiled inwardly at the conditioning this exposed.
"Approximately 20 billion times the speed of light."
Johns looked up, startled at his own words.
20 billion?
"We travel fast," Shetland said, hardly surprising in view of the purpose of this voyage. Johns nodded, dazed.
"Yes. Testing the performance of the drive and shield at the big MPH is a tall order. Takes us right out of the galaxy. And we've just about done it already. 19.283 is one full megaparsec per hour. 1 MPH. Over 3 million light-years in a thin 60 minutes.
Shetland frowned, his fingers beating little cadences on the panel below the clock. Somnanda saw the voyage as a test of the beacon. Johns saw it as a test of the drive. What would Beaton see? The pilot, misunderstanding, launched into another explanation.
"We have to check it out before turning it over to private enterprise. We know so little about the drive and the part of it that we call the shield. Yet it would be impossible to travel in FTL without some kind of protection. Part of the energy of the drive is diverted to form the shield that isolates us from normal space. It's actually an adaptation of the available Cherenkov radiation.
It was time for the shock. Were you assuming that the Mag 2 was going to stop at 1 mph?
John's eyes widened.
We're not stopping, sir?
The intercom came to life. It was Somnanda. Captain, to the beacon as convenient.
Shetland nodded to himself. The beacon had flared. Yet it was not conclusive. He himself had made the beacon react when caught off guard. Every man had his moments.
Does speed frighten you, Johns?
Johns licked his lips.
How much?
30. Johns stared at the clock.
30? Sir, have you any idea how fast that is?
He took refuge in a slide rule.
We're doing 20 billion times the speed of light now, and that will just about square it, Captain.
He shook his head negatively.
To answer your question, sir, no. I can't be frightened by that. I'm used to big figures. But this doesn't mean anything to me. I can't visualize it, so how can I be frightened? Meanwhile, I know the drive can do it, and I'm game to try.
Shetland did not agree with the pilot's reasoning. Most men did fear what they could not visualize. But it seemed that Johns had survived his crisis and come to terms with it. He could not be considered a prime suspect. Beaton had to be the one. He would go and pick up Somnanda's chess move, then gird himself for the most difficult interview.
Why 30? Johns inquired. Sir?
Because that's where death awaits us, Shetland thought.
Orders, pilot.
Death orders?
Beaton's cabin was typical of what was expected of a young spaceman. The neat military bunk, the footlocker, the shapely pin-ups on the wall. Shetland dismissed the pictures immediately. He knew that every man under 30 put them up as a matter of protocol. But after one discounted the window dressing, a man's room was often a pretty fair indication of his personality. Nothing. Everything was in order, allowing no personal signs. Beaton was almost too careful to conform. Only one thing showed personality, a chess set on the corner desk with a game in progress. Even this was no giveaway. Tedium came to everyone in space. He examined the game with a clinical interest, noting the advantageous position held by Black. This game would soon be over. Realization struck him. This was no ordinary game. This was a replica of his match with Somnanda, complete to the last move. A game that he had thought existed only in the minds of the two of them, and Somnanda was Black.
What can I do for you, Captain?
The cartographer had come upon him by surprise.
Beaton was a tall, blond lad. His face had that fresh, out-of-school look, sanguine and unlined, eyes startlingly blue and innocent. But the records placed his age at 24.
I was admiring your game, Shetland said.
Beaton had the grace to flush.
You might call that a spectator sport, sir. As spectator, who would you say had the better position?
Well, sir, I'm sure I could win with White. The captain smiled faintly.
You should know that FTL career men are noted for memory, not intelligence, and that they retain few illusions.
I'm sorry, sir. I must admit that your defense, while logical from a positional standpoint, is unsound in the present case. But I do admire your ability to play without a board. I could never do that.
Shetland resisted flattery, not entirely successfully. He was here to judge, not to be judged, and it was going to be difficult. This boy, the record said, was a virtual genius.
Perhaps in time you will show me how to win with White, he said. It happens that I can see the board in pieces, whether or not they are physically present, just as I can read a book by turning the pages in my memory. Just one of the qualifications of the office.
Beaton sat in his bunk, not wishing to ask directly the purpose of the captain's visit. Shetland did not enlighten him.
Going into research after this trip?
Beaton expressed surprise.
You know?
Then he smiled ruefully. But you study the records, of course. Yes. Originally, those lectures on celestial mechanics and such bored me.
I would sit in the front of the class, my eyes fixed on the little box of rubber bands quivering like worms on the professor's desk, while he gave out with the poop. He used to purse his lips around the word. But all that changed. I'm going to settle down. Get married.
I'm sure Alice is a fine young woman.
Yes.
Our files are thorough.
Fencing, of course, when necessary.
Beaton gave him a curious glance, then made a hint of a shrug. Woman, he said. That's the word that comes between wolverine and wombat in the dictionary.
Shetland opened the big dictionary in his mind and skimmed the page. It was true.
And I want to assure you, Captain, that Megalocarpus specimen on the wall is not Alice.
Shetland rifled through his dictionary again, smiled when he found the word. Beaton was playing games with him, forcing him back.
Do you know how I met her, Captain? I was sitting in a public library studying a text on psychology when I overheard this kind of clip-clop, clip-clop coming up behind me. For a startled moment, all I could think of was a horse. You know the sound those primitive animals make when some rich showman takes them across a concrete street, the metal-shod hooves ringing out like castanets. I couldn't resist turning round in my chair to see what could make that kind of noise in a library. Of course, it turned out to be two girls in heels. But that horse was still in my mind, and you know, their feet did resemble hooves in an attractive way. Their legs were clean and supple, rather like those of a thoroughbred. I laughed out loud. Now I know why they call them fillies, I said. One of those girls heard that, and she came over to ask me just what I meant. Her tone was severe, and that was the first time I had a really good look at her, aside from her ankles. She had on a knitted green dress, form-fitting over an excellent form. Might as well admit it. I was smitten by her appearance. One thing led to another.
So that was Alice.
No, Alice was the other girl. I didn't pay any attention to her at that time. She, well, gets a little complicated. I don't suppose your records cover that sort of thing.
Shetland got the point. The records were illusory. They told him nothing that would enable him to understand this too clever young man. He was being gently told to mind his own business. How he wished he could. But Beaton was still the prime suspect. And if there was fear concealed behind that voluble facade, the captain had to know it. You've admitted that your early scholastics were not remarkable. What caused you to change? For here, perhaps, the record did offer a take-off point. The shift had been abrupt, and it had been from indifferent to absolute brilliance. There were personal comments by several instructors, jumps to accurate conclusions. An intuitive thinker never makes a mistake in theory. Even cheating is not that sharp. Beaton's tone was flippant. Maybe I was afraid, Captain. Afraid that the ghost of my past would come back to haunt me. These days a degree is not enough. There were too many decades of assembly line doctorates that degraded the magic. They delve into your records, as well you know. If I left behind me a reputation for careless work... Was the young man still taunting him? Showing the flag to the bull? Or was there genuine tension now? Though that's an unfortunate way to put it, Beaton was saying. Ghost, I mean. I always was afraid of the supernatural. Sometimes I suspect that my whole interest in science was spurred by a lingering fear of ghosts. As though I were trying to shine a light in the dark corners to prove that nothing non-physical could possibly hurt me, because there was nothing there. Seems ridiculous now. Childhood fears. It did not seem ridiculous to Shetland. For the Meg, too, at this moment, the entire universe had become non-physical. They were traveling at such a rate that an entire galaxy could be traversed in less than a second. And it made no difference whether the ship passed near or through it. How easy to invoke the sense of unreality, to renew the fierce early terrors. How easy, too, to play upon the credulity of a meddling captain.
Does the Academy still teach Einstein? Shetland inquired with a smile.
Beaton smiled too, seeming to relax.
It still does. But of course it's a mistake to assume that FTL disproves his work.
The general theory never did limit an object to the speed of light, though I doubt that the old gentleman anticipated... What is our present speed? Shetland did not miss the nervous throb, the slight terror showing on the tips of his fingers. Beaton knew the time, and he could do conversions. His question seemed like a plea for confirmation, or denial. He looked at his watch. It said 22.9, drive time. Just over a megaparsec per second. Our mission requires high speed. Beaton rose to the bait, definitely nervous now.
It certainly does. This voyage will rewrite the text on celestial cartology. My instruments are recording the placement and pattern of every galaxy and cluster within a billion parsecs of our course, though I must admit that our present velocity makes this seem tiny. It will take many years for the computers back on Earth to assimilate the information we collect in hours. But our journey will be over in 10 minutes.
Shetland could not conceal his astonishment.
It will? Certainly. It began with the vast primeval explosion that flung matter and radiation in every direction to populate the vacant space. Then gravity slowed this impetuous expansion and brought the universe into a state of equilibrium 2 billion light-years in diameter. But when the galaxies formed, the forces of repulsion came into prominence and expansion resumed. Now 5 billion years have passed since the beginning, and our universe has grown to a radius of 3 billion parsecs. In moments we stand at the culmination of it all. Our mission is over. The rim.
To every man, his own justification for the voyage, Shetland thought. To every man, his own disillusion. Not yet, he said succinctly. Beaton's innocent eyes focused on him.
You have to stop, of course. There is no point going beyond the rim of the universe.
Shetland spoke carefully. According to your theory, there should be a cessation of all matter at approximately 23.1 on the clock. I have asked to be alerted the moment such cessation occurs. None has. It is now 23.2 hours. There has been no rim. We shall not stop. Beaton turned pale. His breath came in labored gasps. His eyes stared unblinkingly at the captain. The intercom blared out behind Shetland with startling volume. Captain, to Beacon, immediately. Shetland whirled, paying no more attention to Beaton. He galloped headlong down the corridor, blood pounding in his ears. The shortness of his breath, he knew, was not entirely due to the exertion. He burst into Somnanda's cabin and stopped, appalled. The miniature candle, symbol of Earth contact, was a towering column of fire. Orange light flooded the room, flickering off the walls and illuminating Somnanda's twisted face with demoniac intensity. Shepard knew instinctively what to do. Terror was destruction to the beacon. He stood there, suppressing every vestige of feeling, quelling his own throbbing pulse with hypnotic waves of peace and security. Members of the crew had fears. These were groundless, based on ignorance. Only the captain had authority to know, and he was not afraid. Not afraid. Not afraid. Gradually, he extended the oily calm outward. Somnanda was not afraid. No one was afraid. A temporary shock, no more, to be forgotten. The fearsome color faded. The column dwindled reluctantly down, down, until it returned to its normal pinpoint above the table. Somnanda's countenance relaxed. Apparently a disturbance in the beacon represented physical pain to him. His hands remained above the table, fingers splayed, their backs an angry red. His forehead was shining, and rivulets of perspiration were draining down the side of his neck. "My strength has been overextended," Somnanda said. His words slurred, voice pitched too high. "I cannot protect the beacon again from that." So formal, even after this, Shetland thought. Yet I must talk to him. As Beaton is to me, so am I to this man of the candle. The tension is within me, and it must come out. And when my brain has translated itself into nervous impulses,
and these pulses become the atmospheric vibrations which are meaningful speech sounds, and those sounds have been lost in entropy, then will my problem be over? A farmer once lost a sum of money, Shepin said. He suspected a neighbor's boy of having stolen it, but had not proof. So the farmer went and studied the boy as he went about his chores, trying to determine by observation whether he was, in fact, the culprit. Though the lad performed his duties in the prescribed manner, there did appear to be something surreptitious in his attitude, as though he were trying to conceal guilt. The farmer returned home convinced. Later he discovered the money where he had forgotten it, in his own home. It had never been stolen. He went again to look at the neighbor's boy, but this time the lad had no guilty look about him. The young cartographer looks guilty, Somnander said. He looks guilty, Shetland agreed. He seemed almost normal until I challenged his evolutionary theory of the universe. Then this. But I cannot condemn a person on such circumstantial evidence. I too, in the last analysis, am afraid.
And you can hear the concluding part tomorrow as the Med 2 approaches the rim of the universe and the captain is forced to confront a terrifying possibility. Stephen Hogan was reading The Ghost Galaxies by Piers Anthony. The producer was Gemma Jenkins.
You're leaving the seventh dimension.
You are indeed, and that means my bit's over for tonight, so thanks for your company. Michaela's here next with a classic comedy, so have fun, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Tales from beyond the grave.
Van Helsing makes a deathbed confession. Henry VIII is haunted by his ex-wives. And little Ellie makes a disturbing friend. The Ghostbuster Diaries. Part of BBC Seven's Seventh Dimension. Starting Monday night at 6:30 and 12:30.
Yep, the Ghostbuster Diaries are opened all next week in the Seventh Dimension, and Helen will be here to tell you all about it then. But right now, it's Thursday night on Seven, which means the latest flurry of excitement to hit Steptoe's yard. Despite all indications to the contrary, it looks like it's going to be a good day in Shepherd's Bush. That's next. And then we're all off to the Pleasance for an Edinburgh Festival edition of Just a Minute with Nick.